This is Eileen Steinberg interviewing Herbert Lindemeyer, December 6, 1983. Side one. Please tell me where you were born and when, and a little bit about your family.
I was born in Minden, West Germany, on March 11, 1922. My father was a pharmacist. He owned a pharmacy, which he had bought in 1921. I had no brothers or sisters. Was an only child. I went to elementary school and then later on to high school in Germany. Everything seemed all right until about 1934, when the Nazis had been in power for about a year.
How has your life changed by the Nazi victories in Europe?
Considerably, only in school, as a matter of fact. For some reason, one day, just like a bolt out of the sky, my fellow students didn't talk to me anymore. There was no fight or anything. There were some who belonged to the Hitler Youth, and they told the others they weren't allowed to talk to me. So I went to that school for 2.5 years. My parents pleaded with me to stick it out so that I would get my education.
What years were these?
That was 1934 until 1937, almost 3 years. There was no Jewish school in Minden, so I stuck it out without any one of my fellow students ever saying a single word to me.
Must have been most difficult. Did your family experience anti-Semitism before the Hitler period?
No.
Did your family belong to any Jewish organizations or to a synagogue?
Yeah, they belonged to a synagogue. We had a small congregation, about 150 members. The city had about 30,000 population, so there was one synagogue that was sufficient.
About how many Jewish people would you say were in the town?
150.
That were in the synagogue, but I assume there were more that were in the town.
No, everybody belonged. Just about everybody.
Okay. Did any of the men in your family serve in any national army?
My father was an officer in the First World War.
Mm-hmm. Was he wounded or?
No, he wasn't wounded.
Do you remember how you and members of your family reacted to Hitler's appointment as chancellor in January of 1933?
Well, I remember my parents were very upset. I was at the time 11 years old and I wasn't too concerned. I remember the Nazis marching and they had these torchlight parades, which were frightening. They were singing anti-Jewish songs, but when you're 11 years old, it doesn't concern you too much. But I remember that my parents and my other members of my family, uncles and aunts, were very upset. They had meetings in our house and in their houses, and there was tension.
You mentioned before that the children in school wouldn't speak to you. When you were home, who did you play with as a child? Just other Jewish children?
Other Jewish children, yeah. Mm-hmm. There were two or three, maybe four boys in my class who called me at night and said they were threatened, they would like to talk to me, but they couldn't do it. Four out of a class of 32.
Mm-hmm. But four had the courage enough to at least call you,
at least
not
call me,
to talk
they,
to you
mm-hmm.
in school.
Yeah, what
right.
was that, didn't you?
Yes, and I later, much, much later, in fact, when I came to the States, a cousin of mine told me that my parents had sent a bodyguard going to school and coming from school, because they were afraid that I would be beaten, and
but
I didn't know that.
But were you the only Jewish student?
There was one other boy. He was a little younger, and I started the high school in 32, and he came in 33 or 34, so I wasn't in the same class, but he was in the same school with me.
I assume he was also ostracized in the
yes,
same way.
Same way.
Did you have any contact, or your family have any contact with the Council of German Jews?
Yes, my father was a member of certain mother was a Jewish, what was that called, Jewish?
Veteran.
I guess Jewish Veterans Group, yes, Jewish Veterans Group, and he was a member of that.
Were you affected by the boycott of April 1st, 1933?
Yes, definitely, and not me personally, but my father had a pharmacy, and the Nazis were standing in front of it, not letting any customers in.
None at all, not even Jewish customers?
None at all. Well, you could have forced your way in, but nobody did. And there weren't many Jews, on that particular day, Jews didn't go outside. It was April 1st. Everybody knew that all the stores were boycotted and nobody went out.
What did your father do then if he wasn't able to earn a living?
He was able to earn a living until the Nuremberg laws came out in 1935, I think.
Right, that's what I was going to ask you.
Until that time, he was able to keep the pharmacy, and he made a decent living. And if he hadn't, he probably would have emigrated. This way he said, if I emigrate, I have to learn another language. Here I can still make a living. And how long can the Nazi government last? Another year or two and we can stick it out. And he wasn't the only one who felt that way. There were thousands who felt the same way.
During this early period, did you or any member of your family discuss the possibility of leaving at all, or your father just felt?
My mother was in favor, my father was definitely against it. He said, there's still time. After all, this is the country of the old familiar saying, Goethe and Schiller and these Beethoven, and they wouldn't do anything to us. All right, it's tough right now, but how long can it last?
How were you affected by the Nuremberg laws, and did you think that this would be the worst that you would have to endure?
I personally wasn't affected. My parents were. He had to give up the pharmacy. They didn't take it away immediately. He had to employ somebody who would run the pharmacy, and he was only allowed to help out occasionally. The reason they said was he could poison the German people by selling them poison instead of drugs and medicines. But that only lasted for, I think, another 2 years, and after that, he was forced to sell the pharmacy.
How did you live after he had to sell the pharmacy?
Now, this only came up in 1938, after the famous Crystal Night.
Yes.
Then he was forced to sell the pharmacy. Until then, he had rented it, and he got a... I guess it was a fairly decent amount of money,
right,
so we could live.
During the period from 33 to 38, did you or your family have any contact with non-Jews?
Some.
All right, what kind of contact, and how would you describe their behavior?
Well, some people came to visit us. We had a maid until in 1936, well, she got married and she left voluntarily. In fact, I'm still in contact with her today. She's an old lady now, but people like that were in contact with us, and there was a neighbor's boy who was a little older than I was. He came to see me, and at least for another year or so. His father was a policeman, and he also was forced to break off all contact with our family.
But they were basically the only...
They were basically decent people. And they were basically decent people, because if they weren't, then all Jews would have been killed in 1933 and 34. There were, I will admit, there were a lot of basically decent people. Not, I wouldn't say the majority, but...
Some,
but many were afraid. One of my neighbors worked for the post office. She didn't dare to talk to us because it was a government job, and she would have been fired immediately.
What happened to your family during Kristallnacht?
I wasn't home that night. I was in a different town. I went to a trade school. My father was arrested and sent to a concentration camp.
Which one?
Buchenwald. And I got a phone call that night, and I went home. My mother asked me to come home immediately, and I did. And my father was in Buchenwald until about 4 or 5 weeks. And then he was released because he was a war veteran. He had the Iron Cross. And after so many weeks, they were all released. All those who had the Iron Cross or were war veterans were released because they couldn't have kept them forever. They weren't prepared for it at that time.
The numbers at that time. Did your father talk about his experience? How was he treated?
Not to me, because I was 16, I was old enough, but he was afraid that I would spill the beans somehow. But I heard when my parents were talking, he was in sad shape when he came home. I am sure he was beaten. I don't know, I can't be sure, but it very much looked like it. And it took him quite a while to recover after he came home. Because it was winter time, and I remember his feet were frostbitten. And for several weeks after he was released, he was not in good shape. And then he was more or less convinced there was no future, and we took steps to emigrate. But by that time it was too late. I know for to get an American visa or American papers in general, there was a waiting list. The U.S. government let in, I forget the exact number, 5,000 or 8,000 people a year. And I still remember our number. It was 44,444, so I can never forget that number.
You didn't have much chance.
It would have taken until 1950 or so
for
my parents to get out with that number.
Okay, you said your father sold the pharmacy in 38.
Yes, he was forced to.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do then? Is that the time that you left to go to England?
No, that was a little later. I went back to the trade school in Frankfurt after my father was released. And then we took steps for me to emigrate. And I got the visa to go to England in June 1939. And then I got prepared and emigrated finally on the 9th of August 1939, 3 weeks before the Second World War started in Europe.
Okay. That's when the Germany invaded Poland?
Yes, on the 1st of September.
Okay, and that's the time that you left.
Mm-hmm.
But your parents remained. Did they stay in the same town and in the same place?
Stayed in the same town, the same apartment. They had to take in another Jewish family, and they had to sell some of the furniture. The money that was paid for the pharmacy never got into my father's hands because it was confiscated by the government, and he was given a pitiful sum every month to live on. I don't know how much, but that's all he was allowed to have. So that was confiscated.
After you were separated from your family, when you left to go, were you able to maintain contact with them?
Well, for about 3 weeks, there was no war yet. I wrote to them. Then the war started, and I had an aunt in Switzerland. So I wrote to her, and she forwarded the letters from Switzerland to Germany, and my parents sent mail to Switzerland and then on to me.
Okay, how long were you able to keep in touch with them like this?
I'd say about 6 months, 8 months.
All right. How did you learn what eventually happened to your parents?
I got a Red Cross letter. Yes, I remember now. A Red Cross letter from my parents. They wrote from Riga that they were living in Riga now. I think they used the word living or something like it.
But you understood what they meant.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I knew there was a concentration camp there. And they wrote that they're fine and whatever that meant. And then shortly thereafter in... But for a while I didn't hear anything because I myself was interned in England. So we couldn't receive much mail in the internment camp. But after I was released, I remember in March 1942, I learned that my mother had died first and then shortly thereafter my father died. So they must have died sometime in 1941.
Who gave you the information?
An uncle of mine who was in he was in Theresienstadt, another camp. And they wrote to me that my father and mother had died.
How did they know?
I'm not sure.
Because they were in a different camp.
That's right. It was my mother's sister, so I really don't know how that...
Did they, your uncle survive Theresienstadt?
No.
Did not survive.
No.
Now, you mentioned that you were interned when you were in England.
Right.
You arrived in England in...
39.
In 39.
August 39, right.
Okay, tell me about what happened from the time you arrived, what you did, and tell me about being interned.
I got a trainee permit to work in a... permit to work in a factory in Oxford, England. And I worked there for about 10 months until June 25th, 1940. It was a decent job. I got paid reasonably well, and I lived with an English family, and I did fairly well. And in June 1940, when after France, Holland, and Belgium had fallen, the British government got panicky, which I can understand. Many people refuse to allow that. And at least 25 or 35,000 refugees were interned. Men and women, mostly men, but some women also. And some were sent to Australia, some were sent to Canada under horrible conditions. The soldiers that guarded the prisoners, so-called prisoners on the ships, thought they were all Nazis. There were some German prisoners of war. They were all put together with the refugees. And they were not treated well at all. In fact, after the war, there was an investigation in the House of Parliament in England. And some officers were sent to jail, as far as I know. One ship was torpedoed by the Germans, and several hundred people died. The German prisoners of war were on top of the ship on the main deck. The so-called, the Jewish prisoners were not under the Red Cross protection, and they were down in the hold, and most of them drowned, or at least many of them drowned. The ship was called the Andrea Doria.
The
Andorra Star. Okay. I always mix them up. The Andorra Star.
Okay.
It was sunk by German U-boats.
How were you yourself treated when you were interned?
I was treated well. The first couple of weeks, or I'd say the first 2 weeks, there was complete confusion. They weren't prepared to received tens of thousands of prisoners, and there was little food. But after about 2 weeks, it's all straightened out, and there were very primitive conditions, but we were treated well. I wasn't one of those who were sent to Australia or Canada. We were sent to the Isle of Man. Those people who went to Canada and Australia went to the Isle of Man first. And then when more people came, they were shipped out, and we took over in the Isle of Man.
And that's where you stayed the entire time?
Yes, for 18 months.
18 months. What did you do while you were there? Were you a prisoner? Were you given any kind of work to do?
Yes, we built an airport in the Isle of Man, and we got paid for that. We laid cables and dug ditches, and it was hard work, but at least we did something. We weren't forced to, that was strictly voluntary. And the camp was pretty well organized later on. You could take courses in English, shorthand, bookkeeping and engineering. We had all kinds of people in there. After all, these refugees came from Austria, from Germany. We had composers, we had movie actors, we had engineers, we had professors, famous professors, in fact. We had very famous musicians, authors, all people from all kinds of backgrounds. And you could keep yourself busy.
While you were on the Isle of Man, did you know what was going on in Europe?
Very, very little. We had no radios. We weren't allowed to have radios. In the beginning, the first several weeks, we weren't allowed to have papers. In fact, we expected to wake up one morning and have the Germans stand guard instead of the British army, because we had no idea. People told us the Germans had landed in Ireland. We could see the coast of Ireland from the Isle of Man. And there were rumors that the Germans had landed and the next step would be the Isle of Man. Of course, that never happened, but
we were
scared.
Certainly. You really didn't know what was going on while you were there. You told me that you were on the Isle of Man for 18 months. When were you, and how were you finally released?
The British government published a white paper which had 15 or maybe 25 categories under which refugees could be released. One of them was finding job in defense work, which was relatively easy after all, it was wartime. And judges or people who had law degrees were released, and doctors for military hospitals, and there were many, many categories which most of them escaped me. And I found a job, or I was asked by a defense factory to apply for the job. As a matter of fact, the man took 15 or even maybe more than 15 from the Isle of Man and employed them in his factory. He happened to be a German Jew who had emigrated to England in the 1920s and, of course, was a citizen by that time. And he owned the factory, and he, I'm sorry to say, used us. He paid us minimum wages, and we really had to work very hard there, which wasn't bad, but he didn't feel for us. There were no promotions. We did the lowest jobs. Somehow, I feel he basically hated us. Maybe he was a Jewish anti-Semite, or I don't know what made him click. And I worked there for a year and a half. As a matter of fact, when we arrived there, the first day of work, he called us in his office and said, "Gentlemen, don't think you can use me as a springboard. You're like in a mouse trap. I got you out of the Isle of Man. I trap you here. As long as the war lasts, you cannot get out. Don't try to find another job somewhere else." And that was it. We
Sounds
were stuck.
Like a wonderful fellow.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
So eventually, when did you leave him?
The war ended in 45, May 45. And then things became a little easier as far as leaving a job was concerned. Although we were still restricted, we couldn't just leave. So I heard of an opportunity to join the American Army as an interpreter and mail sensor, to be sent to Germany to censor mail and listen to telephone calls with the occupation army. I applied for the job, passed several fairly tough tests, and was accepted. So I went to my lovely boss and told him, "I'm leaving next week." He said, "You can't do that. I told you, you are trapped here. You need permission." I said, "I have permission. Here it is. I'm joining the army." And he had to let me go. And that was in October 41.
45.
Excuse me, October 45.
Okay.
October 45.
While you were working in this factory, for this man, where did you live?
The Jewish Committee in Manchester, that's where the job was, arranged for us to live in a hostel. It was called a youth hostel, although there were older people there also. And as soon as I was released from the Isle of Man, I headed for that hostel and lived there for a year and a half. My wife lived there also, as a matter of fact, that's where we met. It was in December 41. I worked in this defense plant until September 45. And in the meantime, we got married, and that was in 1944, the 2nd of January 1944, to be exact. We found an apartment, lived in that apartment, and after the war finally ended in May, I tried to get out of the factory. Although it was difficult at the time, there were still war power acts in force, and it wasn't easy to leave the job. So I finally heard about the opportunity to join the American Army as an interpreter and the mail sensor and go to Germany with the occupation army. So I applied for the job, passed several tests, was accepted, and quit the job at the defense plant and went to Germany in November 1945. My wife couldn't go with me at the time because I didn't take married couples, but she was able to follow me 3 months later.
On her own?
On her own. Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell us about your work when you went back to Germany. Did you work together or were you working completely
separately? The
first 4 weeks
she was in a different location, but she got a transfer, and then we had a nice little apartment in Germany in a military compound. We censored mail, mostly German mail, but also some army mail.
Mail coming from where?
Coming from all over the world and going all over. Not all mail was censored, only about 10%. There were 15,000 people working in our division. We had to report many different things, black market activities, Nazis living in hiding. We caught quite a few. We had a so-called watch list with thousands of names of known Nazis either living in hiding or trying to hide. And one of them I remember quite clearly was Wernher von Braun, who in the meantime had gone to the United States to work on the rocket program. Every letter he sent and every letter he received was censored by us. We had many others. We weren't allowed to read the top Nazis' mail. They had their own censorship, those who were indicted in Nuremberg at the time. There were several officers who did that themselves. We didn't read their mail. But it was interesting work, and it was rewarding to catch a few Nazis here and there.
I would imagine. You said you lost your parents in the war. Did you lose any other members of your family?
About 50. Uncles, cousins, aunts. I had no brothers and sisters, as I said, but I counted once and there were about 50 people.
Did you ever go back to the town where you lived?
Definitely, several times.
Tell us the story.
I have very good friends who still live in Minden. There's one man who is approximately my age. His father was not Jewish, his mother is Jewish, he was brought up Jewish. He lived in hiding during the war, and I immediately contacted him when I got to Germany, and I went to see him and his mother. At that time, his father was alive too. As a matter of fact, his mother's still alive. She's 92 today. His father died about 15 years ago. We were welcomed with open arms, of course. I'm still in contact with him. I saw him 5 years ago, and we are planning to go again and see him.
I understand you went back to the pharmacy.
I went back to the pharmacy my father owned at the time, when I was in American uniform, of course. I walked into the pharmacy. The man saw me, the owner at the time, who had bought the pharmacy. He had known me practically from the day I was born, because he worked for my father. He got as white as a sheet. He was afraid he was going to lose.
This is Eileen Steinberg interviewing Herbert Lindemeyer, December 6, 1983, side 2. The man saw you, and what did he do?
He turned white, and I said, Mr. Foss, I'm going into your office. He said, I'll come right with you. I'm busy, but I'll come right with you. He followed me, white as a sheet. He told me that he was happy to see me. I doubt it very much. And I will say he was a decent man all his life. He never did anything to my father. He was forced to take over the pharmacy. He did it willingly, of course. But I wouldn't say he was an anti-Semite. As a matter of fact, he had some very important papers which he had hidden, and he gave to me to help me get some restitution from Germany. So I can honestly say that he was pretty much on my side.
Mm-hmm. But he was certainly surprised to see you.
Yes, he was. He had no idea that I had emigrated, where I was. He didn't know.
Was it when you got back to Germany after the war that you found out what had happened to the different members of your family?
Yes. I found out some of it in England already before I came to Germany. But
do you remember when you first heard that Jews were being murdered in mass numbers or being gassed? And did you believe?
Probably after I was released from the Isle of Man, but I'm not sure. There were stories in the paper. But they weren't confirmed, and we didn't really know what was going on.
Did you believe the stories?
Yes. Having known the Nazis, I believed them.
Did you have any contact with any of your family or friends in Germany between 1942 and 1945?
None at all.
Nothing.
I couldn't write. And the United States were in the war, and there was no way of contacting anybody.
You were alone. You were a young man alone by yourself without any of your family in a different country.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you learn to speak English?
I had private lessons in Germany before I emigrated by an English lady. She taught me. And
was this in preparation for going to England?
In
or?
Preparation, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the lady I came to in England was a school teacher, and she helped me quite a bit. She corrected me, and she gave me lessons, and was very helpful.
Tell me about the woman that you first went to live with when you went to England.
She was an elderly lady, an ex-school teacher, who was a Quaker, and she got me out of Germany, got all the papers for me. I hadn't known her at all. She was a complete stranger to me, but she was helpful to many, many refugees. I think she personally got out about 6 or 7. She wasn't a rich lady, but she helped wherever she could.
Mm-hmm. There were some good people.
Yes, there were quite a few.
Were you able to maintain any kind of Jewish identity while you were in England? Able to join a synagogue?
Yeah, they had synagogues, and the refugees were allowed to join without paying. But there wasn't really too much time. We worked. There was a curfew, and we worked 6.5 days, or 6 days at least. And there wasn't too much time for
free time. Did you feel strengthened in your experiences by your religious faith?
I can't say that. Maybe in the beginning. I was young, but as I grew older, I don't think it helped at all.
You mentioned before that you went back to Minden and you visited the pharmacy that your father had owned. Where did you stay when you went back to Minden?
Well, the first time I was able to travel in Germany after all the destruction, the railways started to run again, was about September 1946, and I made it a point to go to Minden. I stayed in the local hotel and contacted my friend. Since Minden was a small town and my father had a pharmacy, he was well known in Minden. And the word spread like wildfire that I was in Minden. And amazingly enough, I would say about 10 people came to the hotel and told me that they had seen my parents the night before they were deported. Which was an obvious lie, because they wouldn't have dared to. They told me all kinds of stories. They brought my parents potatoes and all kinds of things. And then the payoff, of course, was whether I could give them some money or some food. Or that's all they wanted. As I said, there were at least 10 people who came. And I was always your best friend. I was always your father's best friend. And
these were all the people who wouldn't talk to you when you
exactly.
lived there before.
Mm-hmm. One interesting thing is I found out of my class of 32, and I'm in that age group where all the people had to go into the army, 18, 19 years old. Of my class of 32, 5 are left today, including myself. The others all died either on the Russian front or on the best on front.
Interesting. You said your wife was able to join you a little while after you went back to Germany. Did you work together at all?
We worked together. Mm-hmm. For the first 2 or 3 months she was at a different location, but then she was transferred and we were stationed in one place, had a very nice apartment. I must say it was a very good time. We were the conquering heroes at the time. And I wouldn't call it revenge, but it made you feel good when you saw the Germans crawl and you were the conqueror. Maybe it's not the right attitude to have, but you can't help but feel good.
I can understand it. So you arrived back in Germany November 45, and how long did you stay?
2.5 years. Just about 2.5 years.
And then where did you go?
Then we went back to England because we felt it's time to make a living, because we made an excellent living in Germany with the occupation army. We were extremely well paid. Everything was done for us. We had a maid. We had our shoes shined every day. The laundry was taken care of. The cooking was done for us. We lived like kings. And we figured, well, let's not look for another job. We could have found another job with the occupation army. But we figured it's time to either start a family or at least start to make a living and go to the States as we had planned all the time. So we first had to go back to England and applied for a visa to go to America, which came within a couple of months. At that time it was very easy because the German quota was not filled. And in June 1948 we left for New York.
Did you have any family here when you came?
Yes, I have several uncles and aunts and quite a few cousins.
So you went to New York first, and how soon?
No, we went immediately to Philadelphia. My uncle and aunt lived in Philadelphia.
So you came here right away?
Rented an apartment. Our first apartment was in Logan. We lived there for about a year.
And then you started your new life here?
And we started our new life here. And it wasn't easy to find a job at that time. It was 48. The boys came back from the army, and jobs weren't plentiful.
Everyone was looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when you went back to school to Temple?
Shortly thereafter. First I had to make a living somehow.
What did you do when you first went to work here in Philadelphia?
My very first job was in a gas station at 59th and Lancaster. And there was another one of those jobs where they used you, paid you the absolute minimum. I made $5 a day, working from 7 in the morning until 10 at night, no overtime. I didn't last too long. And then I got another job in a lampshade factory on Arp Street. And that man greeted me by saying, "Are you a German Jew?" I said, "Yes, I am." He was a Russian Jew. He said, "I don't like German Jews. They don't want to work." And I told him, "Listen, I came to the United States to start a new life, to start a family. I want to work. And give me a chance, will you?" And he did. But he again used me. He promised me a raise within a couple of weeks, I guess, and then he didn't come through with it. He claimed it was a union job and he can't pay me more. He also paid me $5 a day. And then little by little, and then I did a job which I hated. I guess it was about the only one I could do at the time. I was a fuller brush man. I hated every minute of it.
When did you actually become a chemist?
Then I got a job as a photographer in a microfilming outfit. It was a commercial outfit that did nothing but microfilm documents. At that time there was a war scare again, and people microfilmed all papers, documents, what have you. Then I started going to night school because I didn't want to keep that job forever. I took up chemistry at Temple University and started to look for a job, which again wasn't easy, but there were ads in the paper. Of for Roman Haas in 1956, and I applied, and they hired me, much to my own surprise. They hired me with more pay than I had gotten at the microfilming outfit. I started there in February 1956, and I'll be celebrating my 28th anniversary in a few months.
That's wonderful. You must be doing a good job for them. I would like to go back just for a few minutes and ask you about your wife, since you met her and she shared some of the same experiences that you did. Can you tell us, you met your wife in England, and she also was originally from Germany. Can you tell us how she got to England?
She was younger, and she was able to join the children's transport. I think there was no quota as far as England was concerned, and they took any number of children, or at least 1,500 at a time. And she was one of them and went to England on the children's transport, lived with a Jewish family in London, and was also interned because she lived in the coastal area. She was interned for 9 months. We didn't know each other at that time. And she was also sent to Manchester to the same hostel I came to in December 41. That's where we met. And Manchester is where we got married in January 44.
So that was a good place for you both.
She worked also on defense work, making uniforms, army uniforms. And she was very lucky. One interesting point was she was guarding the factory she was working at night, a so-called fire watcher in case a bomb dropped. And they had rats in that factory. And a rat climbed up into her slacks. She was wearing slacks at the time. And they ran out of that factory in a great hurry because they were just scared. They weren't allowed to run out, but they did. And about 5 minutes after they had run out, the factory was hit by a bomb. So a rat saved her life.
Her life. Oh.
That's fate.
That is fate. Yes, it is. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences with me.
You're welcome.